Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is February 25th, and this is Richard Benulli. We have a very special show for you today, a reconvening of the Four Horsemen, we call them. This is now the one-year anniversary when we had the podcast with the Four Horsemen just before the onset of the COVID pandemic and the beginning of the lockdowns. The Four Horsemen are David Rosenberg, Jim Bianco, Peter Buchvar, and Ira Harris. David founded his own firm, Rosenberg Research, after being chief economist and strategist at Gluskin Sheff. The firm offers extensive research and information services with a trial service that we will post up a link to. He also served as chief economist for Merrill Lynch and one of the 12 smartest people on Wall Street by Business Insider. And Jim is president of Bianco Research. Since November 1990, he's been producing fixed income commentaries with a circulation of hundreds of portfolio managers and traders. He's regularly featured on Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Barron's, Business Week, Forbes, Fortune, CNBC, CNN, Bloomberg, and Fox News. Peter's the Chief Investment Officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and advisory at Bleakley. He has a newsletter product called The Book Report, BOOKREPORT.com. It offers great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. And Ira's independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He's also served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also most recently. Great. Welcome, gentlemen.
For having us.
Great to be back.
Thanks, Rich.
Maybe we can begin with an overall current view of the economy and the financial markets in general and how it has evolved over the past year. David, your thoughts?
Well, look, it was obviously a year where the economy went south for a couple of months, and then we figured out that this was not the bubonic plague, that as bad as the virus was, it wasn't going to wipe out the population as much as it did with the Spanish flu a century earlier. So, look, we had a situation where the pandemic caused a recession compounded by the lockdowns and the recurring lockdowns. And then I would say that we had a couple of major inflection points along the way. I mean, I think that the markets and the economy have been divorced for a long period of time. But March 23rd was a real inflection point because that's when the Fed came in and announced all its interventionist measures all the way to the high yield part of the market. And that was the day when the stock market bottomed out. Surprise, surprise. The economy continued to weaken for obvious reasons and then began to pick up because of the CARES Act and all the policy stimulus on the fiscal side. So what we had was tremendous fiscal stimulus that helped out the economy, put a floor under the situation. And then we had monetary policy create all this asset inflation, no matter where you looked. Then you had Pfizer Monday, which was another big game changer, and both, I think, for the economic outlook, and of course, for the markets. And then we get more recurring fiscal stimulus, at the end of last year. And of course, the $1.9 trillion, which is in the bag. So look, there's a lot of cross currents here. I look at what the Fed did. People think the Fed's created the conditions for inflation. I think there's a lot of speculation that way, and it's still a forecast, in my opinion. I would say that there's also an expectation that fiscal policy is going to be a huge stimulant for the economy this year, and I would say that's probably going to be the case as well. To me, the big part here is the confidence I think that people have over the vaccines, justifiably, and that combined with the fiscal stimulus and the reopening, we're going to have an economic boom. I think that's the prognosis right now. I would say that's the widespread consensus. I'm not going to disagree with that consensus because I do think that we're going to have significantly stronger growth in the second half of the year. My thought process is basically more along the lines that next year is going to be very difficult. And I say that for really two reasons. The first is that everybody talks about the pent-up demand, if there's such a thing in the services industry. And we're going to get a resurgence in growth, no doubt about it, in hospitality, leisure, restaurants, casinos, air travel, tourism. But that's only 4% of GDP. People tend to forget about that. We're going to get a V-shaped recovery in 4% of GDP. There'll be some spinoffs, but, you know, normally when you come out of a recession, you get the recovery in housing and autos and durable goods with very powerful multiplier impacts. And the dilemma here, I think, for the outlook is that as you get the pent-up demand in services, the fact that we all bought cars and we all renovated our houses and we all bought new homes, we had an unusually strong year for spending on merchandise goods in the same year where spending on services went down for obvious reasons. I think that complicates the outlook. And the one thing that I'll say about the economy is that we don't know how much of this fiscal stimulus is going to be saved or spent. The New York Fed did a report showing that that only 29% of the stimulus checks actually went into the real economy. The rest went into the stock market and went into households paying down debt. So you have to make assumptions on how much of this stimulus actually makes its way into the economy and how much actually goes into savings. That's point number one. Point number two that I would say is that we don't know the extent to which pullback in durable goods after the spending party last year in this part of the economy is going to offset the V-shape we're going to get in restaurants, hotels, and airfares. So there's going to be some offset there from the durable goods sector. And in fact, one statistic that came out in the past week that nobody talks about was auto and housing spending intentions out of the University of Michigan survey is down to where it was in October 2008. So I think that complicates the outlook. It's not on people's minds right now. People think that we've created the conditions for inflation. I imagine that we'll talk about that through the show. But right now, I would say that if you have a 2 to 3 quarter view on GDP, it's going to be looking pretty good. I think the big problems are going to happen more late this year into 2022, and especially as this fiscal stimulus rolls off, we're going to find out that the private sector spending isn't going to be big enough to offset that. So I actually think that we're going to have a boom, and then we're going to have a bust. The market's priced in the boom for the next 3 to 6 months. They don't see the bust yet in 2022, but if the market looks ahead 3 to 6 months, this will emerge as a second half of the year story.
And Jim, your thoughts?
I agree with what David said, that there is no inflation now. And really what the market is betting on is that inflation will materialize, especially in the second half of the year. Any inklings you get of inflation over the next 60 to 90 days has a built-in excuse, the base effect. We all know that the numbers are going to go up when we drop off April and May of last, or March and April of last year. As well, too. So the bond market is trending higher, and the story of 2021 is why. And I've argued it doesn't matter, or higher rates are neither bullish or bearish for equities. It's why they're going up. If they're going up because of the Powell argument, which he reiterated the last 2 days, is that real growth is coming back in a big way, and this is a validation that everything is getting better, then the market will be fine with higher rates. If there's some latent fears that inflation is going to come back into the system, then the market will have some indigestion with higher rates. And that's beginning to see what we've seen in the last 3 or 4 trading days. I mean, up through the end of last week, you really didn't have that in the markets. You do now. It remains to be seen whether or not this continues. My take is, we are going to see some latent inflation after we get the base effects. Where I'll differ from Dave is I agree that the $1.9 trillion stimulus package is going to fill the output gap. But then I think we're going to keep piling on it. I think as soon as they get this thing done, they're going to take a breath, and then they're going to start on a $2 trillion infrastructure program. And then when they get that done, they're going to take a breath and they're going to start on another program. And then, and we're not going to stop with these programs until there's a consequence to them. One of the consequences could be inflation. One of the consequences of them could be sloppy markets. But if you give people $1,400 checks and all you, the public sees is the poor got some money, the unemployed got a bridge to a job, and the rich, defined as people that own stocks, got new highs, then send me another $1,400 check. Unless there's a consequence to this, I think that we're moving ever closer and closer to UBI. And I'll remind you that it was no less than Mitt Romney that has proposed that we start paying people that have kids under the age 18 monthly, starting at $300 a month, depending on what age your kid is. And I'm sure he'll get a wonderful audience for that in the Democrat Party as we move forward from here. So I fear the inflation story, although I would caveat, we don't have it now. And I think that that's what the bond market's starting to fear, too, is that it's around the corner and it's coming. Last thought for you is about inflation. Remember, it's been since what, the mid-90s, since we've really had true inflation to actually consider in the markets. It's been a very long time since we've seen it. And a lot of people are not sure what inflation looks like because it's been such a long time to see it. And if we get it, we're about to relearn the lessons of inflation all over again.
And Peter, your thoughts?
Look, to talk about inflation, I am a believer that naturally the good side, to split inflation up between goods and services, I think that's important to do, that technology efficiency is just a natural suppressant on prices. And for thousands of years, the prices of making things just tends to go down. So that inflation is really more of like cyclical events. And that the secular trend is usually down. Now here on the services side, just because of the nature of our economy, we usually have persistent inflation. So pre-COVID, services inflation was running 3% year over year because of high rents and medical costs and insurance and tuition and so on. And it was always offset by a decline in goods prices or no change in goods prices for the factors that I just mentioned. So I think starting last year, right after COVID had its impact on the shutdowns, you started these spikes at the supermarket and food. And, you know, when you first see it, like, okay, this is temporary. Everyone's going to the supermarket to buy stuff and shelves are empty, but, you know, that'll get resolved. And it wasn't as quickly resolved. And that just was an early sign of how COVID affected supply chains around the world. So now we have what I see as goods inflation. Commodity inflation, but services inflation that has obviously slowed dramatically because of the impact on the services side of the economy. Rent growth slowing down, tuition slowing down, obviously the cost of going to a restaurant, I don't even know how they calculate that now with so many closed or whatever. So the question going forward is, I think we do have the goods inflation, is what do services and what does services inflation do when everyone this summer sort of gets back to life again? To what extent does it inflect higher? Do rents, which have moderated, certainly in major cities, do they start to rebound again because people start moving back to New York or San Francisco and some of these other cities that have seen the biggest rent declines? And, you know, to a point that David made earlier, 2020 consumers shifted their spending to goods from services. But if I bought a laptop for my family in 2020, for my kids for school and myself because I work from home, I'm not buying a new set of laptops in 2021. If I moved to the burbs in the city and I bought a car, I'm not buying another car in 2021. So we'll see whether that shift will reduce the price pressures on the good side, but then accelerate them on the services side. I think on a net basis, we'll have to see how it plays out. But I think right now, there's obviously a bet that the good side, inflationary aspect of that, will sustain itself at the same time the services side of the economy rebounds, and you get a combination of a cyclical rise in inflation. Now, is it something that lasts a couple of months until people get back to work and factory lines sort of normalize, where people are actually going back to work and not calling out sick because they don't feel well or they have COVID or whatever, or is it something that's longer lasting? And we'll have to see. I think it could last into next year, and I think that we'll be surprised at the persistency of it. Eventually, that will be relieved, and inflation numbers will go back down again. But in this kind of a market that we're so dependent on low inflation, a period of higher inflation makes a big deal. And we have to remember that since the financial crisis in 08, central bankers have gotten away with everything they've gotten away with. And I say with respect to zero rates, negative rates, and QE, because inflation was low. That was sort of their license to print. Their license to ease was the low inflation numbers. So if we get higher inflation, I'm not talking about high inflation, if we get higher inflation, that changes that whole calculus. That sort of handcuffs what these central bankers can do in terms of easing. And it makes it even more difficult on the flip side, because you know that they don't want to tighten. But if inflation is actually something that is real and sticky, then it'll be the market that tightens for them. And then it gets to the point where the Fed will have, and other central banks will have, two choices. Do you fight the market and sort of take it on and say, well, I'm going to extend my QE out to longer maturities. I'm going to increase my treasury purchases from $80 billion to $120 billion and by 10 years and 20 years and compress yields, or try to, or do they sort of take a step back and say, you know, market, I should listen to you. I'll see how this plays out. So I'm not going to respond immediately, but let me have an open ear to what you're saying. And maybe you are right that inflation will be an issue. Maybe you are right that the economy is going to rebound sharply over the next couple of quarters. And maybe I should just be less dovish. Now, it's very unlikely that the Fed is going to become less dovish, because it gets into the whole problem of our entire economic edifice is built on where financial markets are. And obviously, you can trace that back to Greenspan, but where financial markets are will inevitably drive where the economy goes, because pre-pandemic, it was a decline in asset prices that caused those two recessions. So then the Fed gets into an issue with, if I tighten, what does that do to markets? Well, if markets fall, well, what does that mean for the economy? But if I don't tighten and long rates go up, well, that's a lot of lost money in fixed income. And if that affects the stock market, well, what does that mean for the economy? So the Fed and central banks, they put themselves in this position. So there's no way out for them. I'm just saying that it's going to be a lot of bad choices that they're going to have to make. But if this unruly activity in the bond market continues, it will be solely up to the Fed and other central banks in order to make a decision on how do they respond to that, because it's in their purview to control it. I think the Fed should be less dovish. I think they should talk about maybe tapering and raising rates. That would calm down the bond market, counterintuitively to many people. But what would that do to the stock market? A tough situation. While I still think that there's going to be higher inflation and higher yields, you know, I'm still flexible in how it plays out, again, with a shift in spending to services from goods and how the supply side of the economy adjusts when we're more open and things can more flow easily without the excuse of COVID and all the restrictions that entails.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Yeah, so all good things. And let me say, you know, the piece that David Rosenberg recorded with that group out of Switzerland last week was really good. Jimmy, I mean, this is, we're really getting at things that are important. And I think Peter's points are taken, but the Fed has done themselves a major disservice by becoming Ministry of Social Justice, which they've taken on for the last 10 months, and they keep pushing at it. I mean, Powell and Yellen are attached at the hip, and they keep reiterating the comments about that the real unemployment rate is 10%, which locks them into a terrible situation. And then what determines the role of Social Justice Ministry is and I'm not locking up with the moral aspect of it, I'm locking up with the financial aspect of it, is when they raise the issue through no fault of their own. So by keep reiterating from Biden to Yellen and started with Powell through no fault of their own, you are now committed to this. Well, if you're committed to this, you own the fact that the blood right now, and David, I'm not poking at you because you've been dead right for longer than I, you know, you and Lacey Hunt, especially, are two people I respect, and you've been dead right for a very long time, and most of last year. But now the Fed has, by targeting their massive amount of purchases, because when I went and did some work on it this week, 80% of them are for, you know, shorter duration, meaning 5 years or less and probably 3 years or less. And they've left the long end to the market. Well, people are all over the world are trying to grab whatever nominal yields they can find, especially the Japanese and the Japanese pension funds and insurance companies. So you have these people buying. Well, right now, that because especially the Fed is not involved in anything farther out, that becomes the path of least resistance for not only the convexity players, but you've had guys like Stan Druckenmiller and other what I call global macro titans, which exist in my world and I have nothing but great respect for. They're attacking on the long end. And the Fed has to own the losses because there are people who are suffering massive losses because they've had to buy those ends. Where the Fed wouldn't buy that, that was all that was left to them. And that's the world we lived in. But, and I'll throw this out there because it bothered me on Tuesday when Powell was testifying. And, of course, he talked about, as others have, about the disinflation. You know, Jimmy Bianco was talking about it, the disinflation over the last 25 years. And, in fact, Powell used that. Well, I would tell you that in my mind, and it's hypothetical, but I think that there's a lot of basis to it, is that the Fed, see, they saw the lack of inflation through all their good policies. I think a lot of it had to do with, of course, the Chinese, who on January 1st, 1994, depreciated the yuan by 50% from 5.8 to 8.7. And the world has benefited because the Chinese have kept prices under control because they had massive investment and therefore massive capacity, enough to shake, of course, the Asian tigers in 97 and 98, beginning with the July 2nd, 1997 Thai baht debacle. And then, you know, of course, we saw everything else that came out of there. So the Chinese have kept phenomenal pressure on global prices. And more importantly, and I think everybody here would agree with it, is that they've massive pressure, downward pressure on wage prices in the developed world. So we've seen all that. But there's, to me, is something else going on, because I keep looking at, and I've been bullish commodity markets very much so, as we've discussed many times, Richard, on this with all types of people. Peter and I have had long discussions about copper and everything else that went with it, and food prices, and with Louis Gavet. And yet the global economy is not running at such a level that those prices should have taken off like that. So that tells me that somebody's stockpiling massive amounts. Now, that somebody can only be China at this point. And it also, the reason I come to that is because if you do an overlay of the Chinese yuan, you know, we've not heard about the weak yuan, not at all, because yuan has appreciated 12, 13, 14%. Why? Because the Chinese have been massively importing all types of raw material goods. So, and if that's the case, then I get into the Michael Pettis argument, which is that the Chinese, because they're a top-down run economy, have made the decision that they're going to become a much more domestic consumption base. Well, therefore, you want a strong currency. But that disinflationary effect, and that's been, I think, the major component of the global disinflation discussion, is now going to disappear. And this, and I think the Fed cannot be more ass backwards when it comes to this. So I'll leave that there for the discussion.
Just continuing on that, David, do you see that trend as China and the rest of Asia stockpiling commodities? If so, how, why, and what commodities in particular?
Well, look, I'm not privy to that data on Chinese hoarding of commodities. But what I do have at my disposal are the net speculative long positions by the fast money guys in the futures and options pit. And across virtually every commodity, except for gold, you're seeing near record buildup of speculative positions in these commodities. Because I think you're right, there's no way that you could even factor in even the reduced negative growth rates or the pickup in some countries. The global economy is simply not growing that fast to justify the run-up in commodities that we're seeing. So I do think that there is firstly a speculative element to this. So I think that you're seeing a lot of speculative trading activity. In fact, you're in the top one percentile on these net long positions from copper throughout the base metal complex in particular. So there's that speculative element. You know, something that Peter Buchvar writes about after when the ISMs and the PMIs come out is you've also had some inventory building. So look at if you have this view that inflation's around the corner, you're going to want to build an inventory. And so there could be that aspect of it. You'd rather buy it and hold it now than have to pay a higher price later. So this is a case where expectations can feed on themselves. But I'll tell you that it is interesting. It's something that Peter Buchvar and I go back and forth on during the day when we email each other. Because when you look at, you know, the thing is that people are looking at these tips break evens. By the way, the tips break evens, I think they peaked in early February. This is not this last part has been real rates. And real rates going up or becoming less negative is less friendly for risk assets and equities than one that's premised on inflation expectations. I think the market-based inflation expectations peaked about 3 weeks ago. This has been a real rate story. But insofar as everybody all of a sudden has got inflation on the brain, it's like it's rather incredible that we went from a year ago when oil prices technically are negative, commodities are falling through the floor, we have a detonation in demand, and it's hard for me to believe that in a matter of 12 months we swung from deflation, and now we're going to swing to massive inflation in 12 months. I just think that's just the markets hyperventilating on both extremes. We never did get the big deflation, and I don't think we're going to get the big inflation for a whole host of reasons that I write about every single day. But let me just say that the reason why everybody's talking about inflation, and there is a front page article on it today in the Wall Street Journal, which tells you that inflation is endemic. Okay, it's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. That's all you have to know to know that it's all in the price. But people look at these tips break evens and they make up their mind. Well, the market must be right. Look at these tips break evens. They're whatever, 220 basis points. But the thing is that the highest correlation between the market based inflation expectation measures, the highest correlation is with the CRB index, which you get in real time on your Bloomberg terminal. So of course, people are looking at commodities and they're saying, well, we got a commodity cycle. We have to have an inflation cycle. And the interesting is that the tips break evens have their highest correlation with commodities. But yet when you actually go to the core PC deflator or the core CPI, there's no correlation. There's no correlation. It's infinitesimal with the CRB. The most powerful coefficient is with the labor market. So it is interesting that and that's the one missing link on the inflation, because I'll just tell you, you have to differentiate between relative prices and absolute prices and the prices that companies might want to charge. But ultimately, inflation will come down to the prices that people can pay. And this is where Powell's probably right, that basically when you look at the unemployment rate holistically, it really is closer to 10%. It's only 6.3 because a lot of people have temporarily left the labor force that will probably come back in. The unemployment rate's 10%. People say, oh, well, look at average hourly earnings. They're up 5% year over year. Well, yeah, because we've had a massive compositional shift in the labor market, because all the people that lost their jobs were in areas like leisure hospitality, where you make 40% less than the rest of the economy. So it's a compositional skew. Interestingly enough, when these low-paying people come back in to the labor market, the compositional shift in the next year is going to work in the other direction, and the year-over-year growth rate and average hourly earnings is going to melt. That's what the inflationists don't see. The inflationists tell you that to expect through May the year-over-year increases to go up in the CPI because of base effects from last year, the carryover from commodity prices. I think that's already in the market. The point I'm going to make is just that it is interesting that what drives the tips break-evens is not what drives inflation down the road. I've actually went back and looked at the success rate. I looked at the success rate of the five-year break-evens in predicting the direction of inflation 5 years later. And the track record is zero. Track record is it's struck out every single time. There's not a time when you've had the tips break-evens, I'm looking at the five-year because I got the history, has ever accurately predicted the direction of inflation 5 years later. So that's why I'm so happy to take this side of the bet. Why wouldn't I? The break-even levels never get it right.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Jim, in terms of Asia commodities and indicators of inflation or deflation?
Yeah, so first of all, on what David just said, we've looked at the tips break-evens too, and you're right, David, they're terrible indicators about what eventually happens. And we used to joke, thank God that that God invented economists, because they're the only group that's worse than the tips break-evens. So that tells you how bad they are.
Can we be worse than zero?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's like to say the worst you can be is random, right? You could either be a fade or you can actually be a right. But the worst is when you're random. And that's kind of where the tips break evens and the economists are, is they're random. They get just enough of it right that you can't do anything with them at that point. But as far as commodities go, yeah, there's been a very strong bull market in commodities, especially my new favorite indicator to look at is the CRB raw industrial spot. It's industrial commodities. It's largely commodities that don't have futures contracts tied to them or small futures contracts tied to them. So they're not just caught up in the whole flow of funds game as well, too. And I like to joke with the CRB raw industrial spot. If you know what tallow is, you win a door prize. it's one of them in there. But that index is booming. It is absolutely going vertical. It's at a 10-year high. Copper's at an 8-year high as well, too. So you've really got a real strong uptrend in commodities right now. But to the point that, you know, kind of squaring the circle, I think we're going to see some inflation next year. And by the way, I need to put a definition on that, the inflation that I think we're going to see. I've been saying to people, the core PCE, a Fed favorite measure, my target is 2.6. 2.6, that's not inflation. That's a 28-year high. It hasn't been at 2.6 since 1993. It was the last time it's been higher than that. And I've said, if you give me 2.6 on core inflation and we push real yields back to positive, you could be talking about a 3% on the 10-year note. If you look at the bond market and the structure of the bond market and the leverage in the bond market, 3% is a lot of pain. That's going to be a lot of pain in the bond market. I understand equity guys, oh, 3%, come on, that's still a low yield. Yeah, but look at the long durations and the convexities in the bond market and look at the losses. Look, the 30-year bond is already down 17% this year. Year to date, it's down 17%, and that doesn't even include today's wipeout. I don't know where it's going to be when it gets updated tonight, but this is going to cause a lot of pain, even if you were to get back to 3% in the bond market. So I've been looking at this idea about inflation coming back and moving higher, and the commodity prices have been confirming of it. Now, one thing to be clear about this, I've tried to differentiate between reflation and real growth and inflation. And I like to say that bond yields move on nominal, expected nominal growth, wherever nominal is going to go. And it's hard to tell the difference between a market that is discounting reflation or real growth because you get wider tips break evens, you get booming commodity prices, you get, you know, people thinking the economy's coming back, you get cyclical stocks to outperform, and inflation, because in the beginning stages of that, you get the same thing. And it's only once it matures does it differentiate itself out. So it's hard to tell right now which one the market is going at. But I've also come back to this idea that 2.6, that's all I need. And it's a 28-year high. And the last thought about 2.6, a lot of people say to me, yeah, well, the Fed has already said that they'd be willing to tolerate 2.6% inflation or 2.5% inflation. And I've always said, it's not the Fed's call, it's the market's call. The inflation rate will go to whatever level that the market has decided it's too much. And then the market will force the Fed. Think about the last two Fed moves. A year ago in March of 2020 and in December of 18, in both instances, the Fed thought that they were on hold. The markets threw a fit in both instances. And within 10 days, the Fed had changed policy. The Fed was on hold in their March FOMC meeting, and then the markets puked on themselves because of the pandemic, and within 10 days, they cut 50 basis points. In December of 18, Powell said, we're going to reduce the balance sheet by $60 billion a month. It's going to be an automatic pilot, like watching paint dry. The stock market puked on itself. January 4th, he comes out and says, no, now we're patient and flexible. So Fed policy will be driven by the markets. As commodity prices go up, if it takes hold that we have inflation and the bond market keeps puking on itself, I think that the Fed will be forced to change itself. One last thought for you. I've also argued, too, that in an era of inflation, in an era of reflation, if the Fed wants to suppress interest rates, the market will be very tolerant of it. In an era of inflation, if the Fed wants to suppress interest rates, that will be taken very badly. Last night, yesterday, Thursday, the Reserve Bank of Australia, the RBA, stepped in and bought bonds, QE'd more on yesterday than they did. They equaled the high they did during the panic of March of 2020. So they basically, the RBA came in and said, enough of the rate rise. We got to stop this. And they started buying bonds last night. Yields went up 11 basis points. They threw up all over themselves. If this market's worried about inflation, every time the Fed steps in to stop the rise in rates, it makes it worse. Now, that's just one instance in Australia, one time. So it's not a trend. But if we continue to see more of that, then it tells me that the market is really coming around to this idea of inflation and that the rise in commodity prices is not necessarily reflationary, but might be tipping over to inflationary.
And your thoughts, Peter, for Asia commodities and indicators of inflation or deflation?
Well, I want to also add an important aspect to the inflation story on the good side. It's that it's transportation costs that have gone up substantially. And a lot of that is a supply side thing. I mean, you take passenger airlines, most people don't know, it's not just taking people. They take a lot of cargo as well. So we've grounded an enormous amount of passenger airlines. Therefore, there's less capacity to fly cargo. And that's why UPS and FedEx, to use them as examples, have had such pricing power. You've had a dearth of containers, which is causing a sharp increase in the cost of just procuring them, let alone getting them on a ship that would ship it to you at a much higher price. And every single thing that gets produced in this world ends up on a ship, a truck, a plane to get delivered. So that in itself sort of embeds itself into the supply chain through higher costs. So on the good side, higher prices are pervasive in many aspects of the chain. So it gets back to, well, what happens on the services side and what kind of offset will that provide? And if things are robust this summer in terms of the economy and the services side prices start to rebound. I mean, I looked yesterday at airline prices just out of curiosity for next Christmas, and there's no such thing as a bargain. Airlines and hotels, and again, this is just a small slice of the economy, are going to be able to charge whatever they want this summer and next winter, anything they want, because a lot of these airlines are not snapping their finger and bringing back all these flight attendants and the pilots. It's going to take time. We've had a lot of hotels that went out of business, so there's less supply. We've had a lot of restaurants that have gone out of business. There's going to be less supply. So I think the services side of the inflation equation is going to rebound. And the question is whether the goods inflation that we're seeing now is sustainable or that recedes, and we'll have to see. In terms of the tips market is just telling you what they think today. What they think tomorrow could be different. It's just like asking a consumer, what do you think inflation is going to be over the next year? You know, most of those people are just looking at the price of a gallon of gasoline because that's a price that they see every day, and they're just throwing out a number. To me, it's when they're asked, what do you think inflation is going to be in 5 years? You know, talk about a guess. I mean, they don't even know what they're having for dinner that night, let alone what inflation is going to be in 5 years. So the tips market, I think people should really just look at it for the trajectory, not what the absolute number is. Again, because the market's going to change its mind on a daily basis. It's just how they think today. David did make the right point, though, that the tips market is highly correlated to commodity prices, particularly energy. It's highly correlated to the price of oil. But with the five-year break-even at the highest level since 2014, oil in 2014, before it broke at the end of that year, was $100. Now it's 60, 63, actually. So there is something more to the move in tips than just oil. But again, the tips market could be wrong, but it's just how they feel today. And when a five-year treasury note got auctioned off yesterday at 62 basis points, when the five-year break-even was 240, you know, there's quite a disconnect. There's no room for inflationary error. And we're seeing that today because whoever bought that piece of paper yesterday getting 62 basis points, well, that five-year today is yielding 82 basis points. That's not a good mark-to-market. So, and I do want to think, you know, David also makes good points in his pieces about the labor side of the equation. And that is going to be very interesting to see, is how quickly workers go back this summer, particularly if you're a restaurant owner. How much is it going to cost you to bring your staff back? How much is it going to cost you to bring back the chefs and the waiters? And if you're a hotel, how much is it going to cost you? And I think that's really a key. Now, a lot of these people out of work, you'd think intuitively it's not going to cost you much because a salary is better than no salary. But it gets back to, well, how long will unemployment benefits run, since even $300 extra a week is 50% of the people are going to make more getting that than working. I know that on the trucking side, their wage increases every single day because they're having difficulty finding truck drivers. And on the manufacturing side, skilled workers are still in a supply deficit. So employers are having to pay up for skilled workers. If you're in construction, if you're in home building, you're paying up for your contractors. You're paying up for carpenters and electricians and so on. So there are parts of the economy where labor costs are going up rather sharply. And then there are others where, you know, there's no bid for them, particularly if you're on the leisure side. So the question is what is the cost of labor on the services side, on the leisure, travel, hospitality side this summer, as the demand for labor on the service side of the economy rebounds? But at least right now, you know, the market is very reactive. It sees what it sees right in front of it. It sees, as Jim said, the CRB Raw Industrials Index at a 10-year high, the CRB Food Index, which is at a 6-year high. It sees the cost of transportation, you know, exploding higher. And then it'll wait to see what happens this summer. But when you suppress interest rates to such an extent, it doesn't take much of an inflationary accident to cause a big problem. Like 3%, yeah, for decades, we would have loved 3% inflation. But when you have yields across the board that as low as they are, when you still have, even after today, $13 or $14 trillion of negative yielding bonds, 3% inflation is actually a lot relative to those level of interest rates. And again, it doesn't take much to cause an accident in the bond market when you have inflation, especially since, as Jim mentioned, that people are just not accustomed to it. They don't know what it's like. They're just used to falling bond yields and falling inflation rates, and they have no idea what a contra move is like. And we'll see whether this is just a temporary contra move or something more. We'll have to see. But there's certain things that are in place that, could make it more sustainable. When I say more sustainable, I'm not talking about 5 to 10 years. I'm talking about maybe over the next year or two.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, so let me pick up in a few spots. In I thought Jimmy's part about the raw materials, that's also something I watch. And in response to Dave, I'm a futures trader, so I see a whole lot of it. I see it in precious metals because I watch deliveries. That's important. But as much as there is, you know, on the commitment of traders and how bullish people are, the grain prices started rising long before because the hedge funds were actually short. And I think I blindsided because if you looked, you can't find a soybean right now to buy. Somebody's bought them all up, and I know who that somebody is. And it makes perfect sense that they'd be buying. They bought all the U.S. There's so little carryover. They are frightened to death all over the world. You look at the latest WASD. That if there's drought in the U.S. this year, it's going to be very, very dangerous because global supplies are so low. Somebody's been buying them long before all the hedge funds and speculators got involved. Somebody bought a great deal. And that, you know, I'm convinced that it's China only because it's been doing it with the yuan. And if you're importing a lot of goods, you want a stronger currency. That's rule number one in when you want to enrich your middle class. When the United States middle class was growing the most robust and had the greatest share of its income, it's when the dollar was very stable and strong, of course, coming out of Bretton Woods. So that was a good thing, and we enriched, and everybody else fed that machine. So that has certainly been going on. But I can't take my eyes off of Powell and Yellen being committed to getting unemployment down. So I have to brush off my Meltzer and really read up on 1946 to 51, because that's where I see this going. The market is baiting the Fed to go to yield curve control extent. And I'm not talking about an Australian, because the Australians are finding out just how misguided that was by keeping the 3-year, you know, down to overnight to 3-year committed to 10 basis points, because the market does what the market is supposed to do and goes attacks where it can attack. So I think the market is now baiting the Fed. What are you going to do? How high will you let these rates go before you start to get very nervous? Or are you selling us total BS about your commitment to the employment situation? And I caution this, but the Biden administration has placed a lot of stock on this commitment, and most of the liberal think tanks are committed to bringing down that level of employment for minorities. And now that, you know, they put women in there, especially because of the COVID situation, where more women have had to leave the workforce because they were needed more at home. So there's a lot of commitment to this, and I just don't see them turning to, you know, I would love to see them do that. Richard Bernstein's piece yesterday was right on target, except I just don't see them do it. And I would caution the Fed, and I caution them very carefully here, that we're seeing these dramatic moves, and they are dramatic on the long end, and a lot of it is due to the convexity. But one thing that's not in this mix is that the Fed does not hedge its portfolio. And the Fed has been a massive buyer of mortgage-backed securities, less, of course, on the long run, but they don't hedge. So where we would usually even have more pressure, that's how breathtaking this move is. We're missing the biggest owner of debt. They're not hedging in this game, so there's no convexity trade for the Fed. It's just for the rest of the market. And I would argue that the speculators are doing their job and going after the Fed and going, how committed are you to this?
Interesting. And final question, given this economic and financial environment we have discussed, where are the investment opportunities? Base metals, precious metals, energy, agriculture, Asia, and or bank equities with good dividends and good risk management? Maybe we can begin with Jim. He may have to leave shortly. Jim?
There we go. Yeah. So I'm going to give you a couple of, out of the box ideas here. Idea one is go with what's working right now. And I think what's working has been the commodity trade. I just don't see it ending right away. I get that we might be a little bit frothy on it. Go with the higher rates trade. Way that you could play that other than derivatives for betting on higher rates would be to own financials, especially banks. I'm not a big fan of banks long term, but they are a high beta play on interest rates right now if you wanted to play them. Third, if you want to real outside the box, and I am a big fan of what's happening in the space, is go with cryptos. Because I think that what's happening in that space is truly revolutionary. It's coming. It's coming in a big way, especially in the altcoins away from Bitcoin, when you start getting into Ethereum and Binance and some of the other coins as well, too. If nothing else, if you're a little bit afraid of investing in that space, spend some time to understand what's going on there. Because I do think that the next big disruption in the economy is going to be the financial services sector. And it's going to be led by this digital move that we've been seeing with these coins. So, commodities, interest rates, play higher commodities, play higher interest rates, you play the banks if you don't want to play some kind of inverse on the bet on interest rates. And maybe take a look at some of the cryptos as well, too. If not invest in them, at least try to understand them with an open mind.
Great. Thanks, Jim. And David?
Right. I would say that I would like to be bullish on commodities, but I can't because it's just a supply story right now. And people are talking about a super cycle. I mean, you've heard this before. You heard super cycle at the peak of the commodity cycle back in 2008. We do have some supply constraints, but it's interesting to me that everybody thinks, Peter Bookvar is talking about, how is the pricing going to be as the economy reopens? Well, as the economy reopens, we're going to get more supply. I find it incredible that, we had a demand deflation, supply inflation. Everybody was talking about a year ago, it's demand deflation, but we've disrupted supply chains. These supply chains are not going to stay disruptive indefinitely. And the one thing we know about commodity cycles is that they look like repeated sine waves over time. So the supply is going to come back. It's foolhardy to suggest that we're not going to draw in more supply when the economy reopens. That makes the alternative argument makes no sense to me. In any event, here's what I'll say, because at this point, I'm very bullish on the Treasury market. It's out of favor completely out of favor. Of course, my view is that we're not going to have big inflation and that we are going to have growth in the summer and into the fall, but that's already into the price. It's in the price. To talk about, we're going to have a booming economy, it's in the price of everything. What's not in the price of everything is the relapse I expect to see in 2022. So I'm going to be patient. But I think you have to take a look at what's priced in. Like the stock market right now at the levels that it's at doesn't make sense to me. We have bond yields back to where a year ago. And yet the PE multiple on forward earnings is 6 multiple points richer on the same. Now the bulls were saying, you can justify these multiples because of low rates. The rates aren't quite as low as they were. So when you take forward earnings and the forward multiple, it takes you to 3,300 on the S&P, not 38 or 3,900. So I actually don't believe the stock market's got a lot going for it right now. And now that bond yields are being driven by the real rate, which is de facto financial condition tightening, there's some problems there. And everybody's here talking about the ridiculousness in the Treasury market. I haven't heard anybody talking about how it ever made sense that you had high yield recently trading with a three handle. I mean, come on. The high yield market was priced for no default risk. We can debate inflation all we want about treasuries and about growth, but high yield, below 4%. But I'd say that, the reason I'm bullish on treasuries is because the strip curve is already pricing in a 2.5% funds rate in the next tightening cycle. And the market already sees the Fed tightening a year ahead of schedule. This has all happened recently. So, yeah, nobody believes that the Fed's going to wait that long. Well, that's in the Treasury market right now. But the Treasury market right now is priced for the funds rate to hit a peak of 2.5% in the next cycle. And if I remember correctly, we closed the last expansion with the funds rate at 175. So hear me out. We had a funds rate of 175 at the peak of the last economic cycle with a 3.5% unemployment rate and 2% core inflation. We have 2% core inflation with a 3.5% unemployment rate, and people think we're going to get inflation with the unemployment rate over 6%. And maybe it doesn't stay at 6% like Peter says. But we already had 3.5% unemployment, and core inflation was barely above 2%. The funds rate a year ago was $1.75. The market's priced for 2.5%, which people will say, well, the peak of the funds rate was 2.5% in late 2018. Yeah, and look at the stock market that delivered. And that's a level that Powell has already acknowledged was a policy misstep. So I'll just say right now, we have a lot of Fed priced in. We have a lot of growth priced in. I want to buy bonds as a hedge against what if things go wrong and what if the consensus view doesn't come to fruition. So to me, this is almost like a free option because everything that is negative for the bond market is already priced into the bond market at this point.
Interesting. And Peter, your strategy and suggestions?
So I'm a bull in commodities. I have been, but to be specific, I still think that oil prices continue higher. I think the demand side will come back pretty strongly as more people hit the road and more people get on planes again, particularly this summer and the fall. So I think energy stocks still have room to run. I particularly like fertilizer stocks within agriculture. I'm not saying they go back to where they were at the peak in the 2000s, but they're a long way off. I'm very bullish on gold and silver, that I do expect broad weakness in the dollar to continue on a secular basis. And because I do think that inflation will still tick higher, that we have not seen the lows in real rates. Also, I particularly am bullish on uranium. I think there's major supply-demand imbalances in nuclear. I think one thing we learned, particularly with Texas, is that nuclear is a key part of the baseload power argument, and it's the cleanest energy there is and the most sustainable. So combine that demand side with a major supply-side issues that we're going to notice in the next couple of years, uranium looks very attractive. I think investors really also need to look outside the U.S., I'm very bullish on Asia. I think there's a lot of parts of the Asian markets that look very attractive. Singapore real estate, as people leave Hong Kong. Hong Kong, I'm a believer of, notwithstanding, it'll never be the same. But Singapore is going to be a beneficiary. So there are plenty of REITs in Singapore that will benefit from more traffic in offices and retail. Also travel in Asia. One thing they have is not just an aging population that will like to travel, but they have a growing middle class that likes to travel. So like the travel agency stocks, the Macau casino stocks, I think are very interesting as they come back online this summer. And there are also, you know, interesting value stocks within the U.S. I mean, value has been neglected for the last decade, as we know. And if rates are going to rise, I'd much rather be in a stock that's trading at a 10 times multiple of earnings rather than one that's trading at a 10 times sales multiple that many software or in other areas of technology are in. But I think the key is to look at the investing landscape globally. I do like banks, but I don't initially care for U.S. banks. I think some of the Asian banks are pretty interesting because there's actually interest rates do exist, positive interest rates do exist in Asia. And I think you have a combination of that and also the secular growth trends that make some of the banks in Asia, especially some of the ones in Japan that have been destroyed. The Japanese bank stock index is down 90% from where it was 30 years ago. But even Japan now has a steeper yield curve. And a lot of these Japanese banks have, over the last 30 years, expanded their loan books outside of Japan. So they're also a beneficiary of the general growth in Asia.
Great. And Ira, your strategy and suggestions?
Well, everybody's covered the banks, and I'm with Peter. I own Japanese banks, and I bought more in recent after holding them for years. It's not been a good investment, except that it's been a dividend earner and a placeholder. So, okay, but they've been miserable. But now they're starting to perk up a little bit. UBS is still my favorite because it plays into Peter, because I'm also a believer in the Asian story, and UBS is so well positioned as a wealth, manager in Asia. So that appeals to me. And I actually just bought Commerce Bank recently because I read that piece, and I didn't know that Cerebus owned as much of Commerce did, and that they were cutting all these jobs. So I'm figuring, yeah, with Cerebus at the table, they must be getting ready for a some type of merger, either with Deutsche Bank or selling themselves, because it's been such a dog, as all the European banks really have been dogs. So I do think that there's, if rates start to perk up, and I say if, because again, our beloved Philip Lane was out, you know, carping today and making noise. We didn't hear much from Lagarde, but he was out talking about the need to possibly stem the rise in the curve. And actually, Europe has done a better job because they have 19 variables in which to play in. So they can, they're really doing yield curve control anyway, by the way that they move around between the high yielders. Yeah. Italy at 50 basis. Well, now Italy is up to what, 79 basis points today after being down to 48. So we call those high yielders, but there's room to play there. I still think the commodity story has legs because, and I caution, if the yuan would start to weaken, I will step back from it. And I've been paring some of my equity holdings in that, you know, because as I've talked many times about that I owned Archer Daniel, of course, and Bungie, and as with Peter, some of the fertilizers. I've been paring them back here a little bit because to me the rise was just too great, and I'm not a Reddit a Robin Hood person. So when I see stocks that were so unbeloved, and which was a great attraction back in May and June, they were so unloved, and they had still nice dividend yields for the most part. And Freeport tripled, and these have been, you know, too much for me. So I do pare back some of them, and I'll wait to see this story unfold a little bit. And I still remain bearish on the dollar. I think the Fed, until I see some clarity that they're actually going to raise rates or allow rates, the curve, to even steepen further. Because I don't know that we really understand the curve in its historical basis here, because we've never seen this with zero rates, you know, at the zero lower bound, as many of the Fed academics would say. So we've never seen this. So to me, I'm watching, and I think David's right about it. What we're seeing, to me, the 30-year is probably the most investable piece of paper that there is, because at least on a real return basis, it's now has the real yield. Yes, there's duration risk, but nobody cared about duration risk prior to this. So we do now have a situation where the tail is going to wag the dog, maybe. But how far will this steepen until the Fed gets a little bit nervous? And Powell has said he will not go down the path, because of the employment mandate, he will not go down the typical path, which is the path that I think we've all loved, is that when the curve steepens, the Fed would react because they'd say, oh, we're behind the curve, and they would start raising short-term rates. But Powell at the last press conference in January said he's not going to go down the rate. That's the classic business cycle response. He would be reticent to go there. So there's some things that I want to see. And in that vein, it makes me bearish the dollar anyway, regardless. And I don't think that Yellen is a, you know, first of all, I don't buy that strong dollar advocacy. I think that's nonsense. And we've heard it. Everybody says Rubin, but Rubin, it was the Rubin Treasury that did intervene to weaken the yen back in June of 1998, right after they had given a big speech. And we've heard the Swiss National Bank talk about, oh, we're going to hold the peg, and a week later. So I don't buy that nonsense, to tell you the truth. And to me, I think there are voices in this Fed and in this administration who would like a weaker dollar because they believe that it would be positive for jobs. I'm not I still want to see that. So those are the things I'm looking at.
Excellent. It's been an insightful discussion. How can our listeners learn more about your work, David?
Well, what I would invite everybody to do is just Google Rosenberg Research, and it'll take you to the website. And if you just click on the registration button, we will give you for free a full month's of our research for you to kick the tires.
Excellent. And Peter?
If they're interested in wealth management services, they can go to bookleafly.com and reach out to me. If they're interested in reading my daily missives, they can go to bookreport.com, B-O-O-C-K, report.com.
And we'll have a link for Jim's work, and just final for Ira.
Still, you know, I do a lot with you, Richards. Thank you. And I'm, you know, you've really been so gracious in doing this. And of course, I'm still writing twice a week for the most part, Notes from Underground, where I get a lot of feedback and open it up to really good discourse and, you know, try to ferret out the best ideas. Cause I certainly look to other people to make the case, yes or no. That's why I love these, and I love talking with David and Peter and Jim, because you get to ferret out some things, and nobody knows everything, and we all need to learn from each other. So these are really good opportunities for them.
Awesome. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.